It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, November the 2nd, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and I'd love for you to come join me at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com website. You could sign up to be part of our chat free of charge if you want to get some premium content. It's the price of a cup of coffee a month, actually less depending on where you go. You can get updates about the show, all sorts of things, so check out TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and I'd love to thank the folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. Well, it's November, and the baseball season is officially over, and the hot stove is beginning. A little bit of a moratorium over the next 5 days, but it should, the rumor mill has already started, but it should start getting hot and heavy before the end of the week. You know that it's the baseball off season, the first day of, daylight savings time going away, a little bit darker early here on the East Coast. You know, I'm coming to you late Sunday afternoon. It's already dark outside, so you know it's the off season. It's that period of time where you get less daylight. You know, the summer is way behind us. And then, of course, the Dodgers are world champions, a classic Game 7, a really classic Game 6 and Game 7, a good, 48 hours of baseball. Major League Baseball had a great World Series. And I saw some dialogue over on X earlier today with people saying it'd be a shame if the sport, which looks like it's headed for a real battle, a real labor battle, but you know, depending on how this season goes, with the way that the sport played out, a great World Series, a classic Game 7, you know, might be up there with some of the best Game 7s we've seen. I mean, some people compared it to the 1991 Game 7 between the Braves and the Twins. I mean, it's right up there for sure. And, we'll talk about really, what some of the things that I think the World Series and the postseason taught us and what maybe we use to look at the Mets going into the offseason. There'll be a new pitching coach, and there's some rumors about who it'll be. It looks like it's going to happen. I'll give you some thoughts about that. And then we're going to really get into today the start of the hot stove. I've been covering over the last month since the Mets were eliminated all different facets of the roster, the bullpen, the starting rotation. We went really deep into the starting rotation, a big theme of this offseason, the offense and the challenges the offense has with staying a very good offense, but also improving on the defensive side of the ball. And of course, if you've been subscribing to Beyond the Mic, I dived a little bit into some of these things also on the premium part of it, but we'll highlight and we'll summarize and we'll get you all started here on the offseason at the Talking Mets podcast. So you look at yesterday and you look at the World Series and you look at the margin of error and how the Dodgers were a couple outs away from really, I mean, nobody could have criticized them from falling short in Game 7, not repeating as champions. The last team to repeat as champions were the New York Yankees in the late 90s. It's been over two decades. It's been 25 years. It was extraordinary what the Yankees did. It's extraordinary what Oakland did in the 70s. It's extraordinary what the Blue Jays did back in the early 90s. It's very hard to repeat in sports. It's getting harder as the leagues have focused on parity. But when you think about what the conversation is all about and what the conversation has been all about, which is about payroll and salary floors and salary caps and how there needs to be more parity in the sport and the Dodgers are bad for the sport and all the things that the Dodgers spent money on the pitching, the big names, Ohtani, the home runs, and all the things that we talk about. The World Series came down to a backup, late 30s infielder, very light-hitting infielder, hitting a game-tying home run, a defensive play that kept the game tied. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, maybe, not the greatest fundamental lead. There's been some debate on that where, you know, how far off third base he was. Former players saying he played it right, but a small thing about taking a lead came into play, defensive plays, great play in the outfield to save the game. I mean, so many small things, even a great plays in Game 6 on the defensive side, a wacky umpiring call with the ball, maybe not getting stuck in the outfield fence. You look at the things that went into play to really, you know, these are the things that secured the Dodgers a championship. All these little things together, how they turned out, the bounce of the ball, and you make your own breaks. Luck is a product of design. The fact that you're stacking the deck and putting probabilistic outcomes in your favor makes it such that the Dodgers are in a position where those things could potentially go their way. But when you think about it, none of the things that really factored into the final outcome, or the big things that factored into the final outcome, were things you could prepare for. I mean, it's things that, okay, defensive plays, bounce of the ball, base running, you know, maybe a little luck, BABIP luck on some of that. You know, clearly, you know, you don't script your season with a backup infielder who's going to probably retire in a year, hitting the game-tying home run. That's not the player you want up there, or the player you think is going to get the job done. So as you go forward and you see this, really, the only thing that you as a fan could hope for, and I think that this is where you set up the offseason here for the Mets and David Stearns, who have a big task in front of them, an angry fan base, an owner that has put out an edict 5 years ago to win a title, and the Mets haven't come close enough to do that, a team that juiced up its fans with a magical season in 24, only to follow it with one of the more disappointing seasons in the team history. The vibe couldn't have gone from one end to the other. It's a total 180. And I think that, you know, that played a little bit into the perception of the team. But all the things that you do in the offseason, all the things that Stearns is going to be tasked with, whether it be getting an ace, improving the depth of the rotation and bringing in guys with innings, or finding the next breakout starter, improving the defense, what is he going to do with the bullpen? All the things that we're going to talk about, everything that will go into play to plan for 2026 and the different phases that we go through, it really doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, the sport is a tournament. The sport has a very thin margin of error. I always say this. I said it a billion times, so I'll say it a billion and one. Billy Epler said it years ago. When you look at the best teams, I think that he said something in Vegas, they have like a 17% chance of really winning a World Series. That's the best of the best. So much could go wrong. I mean, look at Toronto. They're coming home up 3-2, and they can't, you know, at a great home field advantage, they can't get one of those two games. And a lot of that had to do with the games were right there for them. A couple of things go a different way. A couple of bounces go a different way. There you go. They're world champs, and the Dodgers are sent home. And maybe nobody's talking about them being bad for the sport. But I think that when you start to look at how the sport is such a tournament sport, I think it's really important, as Stearns heads in this offseason, and as much as there's going to be pressure to get things done at any cost possible. And I have no problem with that when it comes to money. I mean, right now, depending on how accurate the reports are, you can't be upset with how Cohen is investing money. He's investing 90%, according to reports, of his revenues into payroll. I mean, he's spending almost every dollar he makes on this team into payroll. You can't ask for more than that. You know, 9 out of 10 cents is being put into the payroll. And I suspect that will continue to be the case as he tries to build the brand, as he tries to get this casino built in this metropolitan park, and the team is that attraction. Everything else will be there. Everything else will be a part of it. But right now it's the team and getting people to want to watch the Mets and the Mets to be part of the culture of the city. But when you think about all that, when you think about what Stearns has in front of him, you can't support a situation where you blindly look past the future just to make a move. Look, there's a couple of aces that potentially could be available. Probably only one in Skubal, and it's even debatable if the Tigers will make him available. And who knows what Paul Skeens in that situation is. So there's not going to be a lot of aces available. There may be some guys on the next rung, a Joe Ryan, a George Kirby, guys like that. But, you know, you can't just go out there because you need pitching or you need top of the rotation pitching and write a blank check in terms of prospect capital to whatever team. You could go out there and spend whatever money. It's just Cohen's money. But when it comes to acquiring players, especially trading from what is now a top five farm system, I think watching the World Series, watching how the margin of error is so thin, watching how certain things, you know, are so out of your control in this sport, in a tournament sport. Yeah, the Dodgers won 3 of the last 10 World Series, if you want to count the COVID season. And that's tremendous. And they've been in a couple of others outside of that. But it took them a while. It took them about 5 years to really get to that point. About 5 years before they were able to, you know, really start to win pennants and put themselves in the position they are. And I think that's kind of where the Mets are now. Are they ready to take the next jump? But with a potential lockout, with potentially a CBA that's going to at least penalize teams for spending money, I think the farm system is going to be important. I think it's all in, and what all in looks like at the deadline during the offseason. I think everybody looks at what AJ Preller's done, the amount of prospect capital to keep the Padres relevant, to keep the Padres on the front pages of whatever baseball publication is out there. You know, that's not necessarily the all-in I want to see David Stearns do. Because look at where it's gotten San Diego. Look at how things could go so bad in a tournament sport where you could have the perfect season and you could have everything going for you and you could be out in a blink of an eye like the Phillies. How the Dodgers were nearly eliminated. Look at Seattle and their heartbreaking loss. Nobody's more heartbroken than the city of Toronto right now, the country of Canada, with how things went down. I mean, that's a gut punch World Series loss. And I'm not saying you don't try, but what I'm saying is I think there's a balance between what's the length you go to solidify the roster and rip up prospect capital, or even, you know, if you're looking at it from a standpoint of payroll, where the Mets could spend whatever they want, how are you locking up your payroll with certain players that you're, you know, to make sure that you have the flexibility you need to continue to build that roster and be involved in free agencies in 2027, 2028, 2029. And I think that's going to be a real balancing act for Stearns this offseason, because if Scooble's available, how deep will he go? And if he doesn't pay the price, if he doesn't overpay, if that's what it's going to take, are Mets fans going to be tolerant? Is the media going to be tolerant of that? Two of the biggest decisions, which I think are not really that big of a decision, but also could come with a wide range of consequences in terms of future payroll flexibility, if there are restrictions on payroll or penalties for spending money, are both the two biggest free agents on the roster, and that's Alonso and Edwin Diaz. And then how do you decide who is the next import pitcher or trade that you make for the next pitcher that you could bring in, knowing that, you know, possibly pitchers, and maybe there'll be longer-term contracts that Stearns has not been typically giving out since he's been part of the Mets, or maybe contracts he's not as comfortable with. You know, what is that decision, and where do you go at some point? You know, is it worth some of the things that you're playing with, this whole blindness, so to speak, of what the new rules are going to be? So this offseason is really an interesting situation. Stearns finally knows what he has in the organization, so I think he has a good idea of the hold of prospects he's willing to trade and hold. You saw some of that at the deadline. What is the right ones to hold? What are the right ones to sell? That's always, the Yankees have done a great job on that. The Yankees don't trade an Aaron Judge, but the Yankees will trade a Florial. The Yankees will, you know, trade some of their other prospects that may not be guys that they feel are a fit or as good as what they keep. I mean, can the Mets do that? Do the Mets have the ability to market or even to make a deal because of their depth without putting some of their top prospects in there? And at some point, what does going all in mean? And can the fans accept the fact that sometimes going all in means you go into the season with the roster, a roster that you tweak or parts of the roster you tweak, and even at the deadline, and you look at some of the criticisms of Stearns this past deadline because he didn't go out and get a starter, but as he said in his postseason press conference after the season ended, hey, look, some of those deals would have been very painful. And then you look, it only gets you an extra week, like San Diego, like Philadelphia. So what you learn from this postseason is the margin of errors in baseball still, or all these variables that you can't plan for. But you did see some things that the Mets don't have, and the Mets have to really address. I think offensively, the Mets are right there with some of these postseason teams. Maybe the Blue Jays and Dodgers are a tick better. Maybe their depth is a little bit better. But I don't think the Mets are that far off in terms of scoring runs versus these teams. I think when you look at the starting pitching, the Dodgers, especially with healthy Glasnow, healthy Yamamoto, who's emerging to the ace, giving you the ultimate what if you're a Mets fan. Otani coming back and starting to pitch and be this generation's version of Babe Ruth, a player that probably we may never see in our lifetime, and who may go down, and arguably may be already happening, as the best player of all time. And then you look at, you know, their bullpen and how they're able to go and get Sasaki and convert him into a bullpen arm, and even with the compromised bullpen, find just enough outs there. You know, last year they didn't have enough starting pitching, so the bullpen carried them. This year they had more starting pitching that went deep, and they were able to squeeze through with just enough bullpen because of the depth, because of the way they've developed their team. And everybody talks about the Dodgers, and they talk about, you know, the spending, but it's not just the big money like the Ohtani, the Freddie Freeman. Of course, those are the core and the hub, and you need those. But it's, you know, finding the right veteran players, having a Kiki Hernandez get big hits, a Miguel Rojas, you know, finding those bullpen arms to get you through the season that actually could get some leveraged outs on the days that you don't have your A team. You know, what does Stearns do to address all that? How far can he go to round out the roster? And the fact that everybody's going to be focused on Skubal and the big names, you know, that's what's going to drive the hot stuff. That's what's going to drive the conversation. But ultimately, what makes the Dodgers who they are and what Stearns has not yet really brought to the table is the around the margins and quality around the margins. And part of that's development. Some of that has to do with the pitching coach that it sounds like they're going to be bringing in. We'll get to that after the break. And, you know, when you talk about all in, how far Stearns goes to balance both of those sides, the pieces that he has and the prospect capital he has that may be able to start contributing over the next couple of years. And what do you keep and hold on to? And what do you, you know, say, hey, I got to take this risk. It's a tough conversation. This is where the toughness of being in this market and having like an owner like Cohen is finally coming to fruition in front of our eyes. Sandy Alderson talked about it in the introductory press conference. When you have so many resources and so many choices and so many options that are in front of you that are limitless, sometimes finding when to hold them, you know, when to fold them, when to go all in, when to back off. Sometimes that's the hardest challenge, the biggest challenge. And I think that we're now there with David Stearns in a critical offseason, an offseason that the media and the fans want headlines in December. But those headlines in December have to yield wins in June and July and then ultimately October. Because if they don't, then it's just no different than the Carlos Correa signing. It was a great cold holiday season, hot stove morning that didn't yield very much when it was all said and done. And you want to make sure that the conversations that we have in December are relevant when it's summertime and we're having our barbecues and we're celebrating the 4th of July. And instead of us already talking about the next season or, you know, frustrated with the current season, it's part of a solution to, potentially a championship season. So it was really interesting throughout the postseason seeing that the sport, at least now the Dodgers and the Blue Jays, putting more of an emphasis on starting pitching, putting more of an emphasis on pitchers maybe going a little bit deeper. I mean, the Dodgers more so on that. And, can the Mets take a page out of that? Are they able to rebuild this staff where finally, for the first time since Stearns has been GM, that they have a rotation of pitchers that can get you into the sixth and seventh inning and give you quality starts? I'm not saying everyone is going to have to be an ace or be Yamamoto or be Skubal or any of those guys, but start to have more than just that average 5 innings, 2-3 runs starter that has really been the trademark of the value rotations that Stearns has had since he came on board. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. We'll talk about the offseason, set the offseason up in a little bit. But after we take this quick break, Mets have a new pitching coach. Is it good? Is it bad? I'll give you some of my early reactions to the pitching coach right after this. All right, we're back. So the Mets made a couple of moves this week on the coaching front. Troy Snitker, you got that last name right. Son of Brian Snitker, who was manager of the Braves for a long time, is now the hitting coach along with Jeff Albert, who was brought over from the Cardinals organization, or used to be with the Cardinals organization and left. They then announced, or it was came through the wire yesterday, Justin Willard, who was the director of pitching in Boston, now being part of the Mets and Mets being the Mets pitching coach and running the whole shebang. And it's hard for me to really comment on these moves because in the old days, you had all these tried and true managers and coaches that had, reputation. You think back like the Pirates and Ray Miller, you know, work fast, throw strikes. you know, things that are kind of like basic mantras. And he became a really, you know, well-respected pitching coach with those simple mantras being in there. You know, Leo Mazzoni looked at it as a genius because he had a couple, you know, three Hall of Famers on his roster. And then as far as managers, the Tony La Russas, you know, the Earl Weavers. So we've come a long way from work fast, change speeds, throw strikes, which is kind of like this, you know, philosophy that all pitchers that were with the Pirates did, and that Pirate pitching staff, which wasn't great, was greater than the sum of its parts, taking that team to three straight division titles and Ray Miller looking like a genius. We've come a long way from that to now organizations hire people that are managing a organization-wide philosophy. And it's so much deeper than just a mantra. It's, you know, using biomechanical data. It's using video. It's pitch shaping. It's basically having a philosophy up and down the organization about how every hurler, with whatever their repertoire is, whatever their body type is, whatever their ceiling is, the best version of themselves, so to speak, is, they're going to try to fit him into their organization philosophy. You'll probably see certain types of pitchers come in. It's certainly going to be a data-driven approach. And even with the offense, it, you know, we've talked about it. We had Ernie Dove on last week, and he's talked about it since the summer. We've had Ernie on a couple of times. He's clued in with the organization. It doesn't really matter to me who's running the pitching or the hitting, because we don't know anything about any of these guys. It all that matters and ultimately will matter is the philosophy that the organization has put in place on offense, hitting the ball hard, focusing on launch angle and hitting the ball hard. On pitching, it looks like one of the things they want to focus on is their ability to throw strikes more. Good thing. You know, one of the things that this, you know, Willard did with the Red Sox organization is talk about honing their stuff and making sure that this nasty stuff that they have is within the strike zone. You know, working on their breaking pitches. You know, organization-wide, it seemed like with the Red Sox, he had a huge impact in the development of certain players. In a lot of ways, it's simple. Throw strikes, take these nasty spin rates, these nasty pitches, these, you know, great arms. And the Mets have now three golden arms. We'll see how they wind up, you know, playing a part in this winter, whether or not all three are all still on the roster. But the Mets have a few golden arms in Jonah Tong and Brandon Sproat and Nolan McLean and maybe a couple more that will join them. But, you know, as far as the pitching coach, I can't sit here and say it's a good move or a bad move. All I know is that Willard was part of the Red Sox organization that seemed to start to and has always had a really good pipeline of prospects over the last couple of years, more so on the offensive side than the pitching side. But Andrew Bailey, who you guys might remember, was a former closer, you know, got hurt. His, you know, career was cut short a little bit. Red Sox pitching coach, you know, Willard learning under him, a well-respected pitching coach who has a modern mindset and, you know, was actually a name that I think the Mets were looking at back when potentially I think it was either they were hiring Hefner or when Olderson came in and maybe was looking to shake things up a little bit. So, you know, is it going to be better than Jeremy Hefner? I don't know. I think some people were disappointed. I saw throughout social media when they saw kind of the news come down, but because they don't never heard of this guy. He's 35 years old. He never played big league ball. You got to get over that. You know, sometimes people will get excited about a former pitcher that they happened to see pitch many moons ago and they liked becoming a pitching coach. At the end of the day, it's more about how that pitching coach is going to execute an organization-wide philosophy, incorporate data, have people as well as he speak to the players in a manner that makes that data digestible. You know, what kind of arms are they looking to develop? You know, are they going to keep these guys healthy? That's part of the biometrics and the body and all the other things that go into play. Things that are far above my pay grade and my knowledge level. But let's put it this way, you know, they have a plan. Now, whether you like the plan or I like the plan, it doesn't matter. It's Stearns' plan. And as I said at the beginning of the offseason, and this is something you got to really get through your head, this is Stearns' baby for 5 years. He's into year three. He's not going anywhere. He's getting paid a lot. So we could complain, not like it, not like his moves, not like his strategy, not like the way he goes about things. We could certainly critique it. And at the end of the day, after year five, if this team is a mess, then we'll know what the, you know, which side the critics were on here. But at this point, all we can do is be passengers in the backseat of the cab here and say, hey, you know, we have to sit back and essentially just, you know, roll with the punches. We'll learn more about this move, I'm sure, over the next few days when it's officially announced. I'm thinking that Eric Jaeger is a big part of this, if I have to think. I don't know much about Willard and his Driveline connections, but I'm assuming there's a lot of components of what Driveline preaches into Willard, because I think the organization is really buying into the modern philosophy of pitching that, you know, Jaeger is from Driveline, so why would he not bring that to the Mets? And I think now you're seeing, like I said at the beginning of the offseason, Stearns bringing in his own guys. He gave it a chance. He started to wean in his guys. He didn't want to just come in and throw an anvil over to the whole organization, and he wanted to rip it all apart from day one. He just subtly has moved in that direction, and I think this past season it gave him the, you know, essentially the equity to go in and say, hey, we had a disappointing season, and now I got to start making some changes. And he said it in the post-game press conference, the postseason press conference, right after the final game of the season. He wanted to bring in coaches that he felt could support the players better, and he didn't think the coaches he had on the staff were doing that. And now he's brought in quite a few on both the offense and pitching, and now it's about going out there and improving the roster, and we'll see how he can do that. So not much. I know that you're probably looking for me to kind of give you some big detailed thought on Willard, but I don't know who Justin Willard is. He comes very highly regarded, it sounds like. He worked under a highly respected pitching coach with a really good organization in Boston. All of that is what I go by, and that's a positive. How this turns out, I guess we're going to have to learn a little bit more about him. Sit back and watch. So, all right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's set up the offseason. What is the offseason going to look like? Let's put our stamp on it. I'm going to tell you what I would like to see. I've kind of laid out some of the things and the categories and the ways I'd like them to approach the offseason. I'm actually going to give you names of preferred players out of those categories. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, we're back. So basically the Mets offseason starts and goes in so many different directions and becomes a lot more confusing and maybe interesting, but maybe a little bit more nerve-wracking with the Pete Alonso and Edwin Diaz situation. Now, I think the Edwin Diaz situation is far easier. We still don't know if he's going to opt out. Pete was very honest in his post-game after the final game. He was opting out. We know that. And with respect to Diaz, I think, and I wrote about this over Beyond the Mic for some of those premium subscribers, you already have 3 more years left on the contract. 2 are Diaz option years for about $18 million. 1 is a team option for $20. Usually 4 years, about $80 million is probably what a top closer like Diaz is going to command on the market. When you look at the big teams like the Dodgers, like the Yankees, like the Red Sox, you know, we don't know what kind of spending San Diego will do. They have their own closer potentially being a free agent in Suarez. I don't think the small markets or mid-tier market teams are going to get involved in spending $20 million a year for a closer. When you start to look at that, you just don't see the market for Diaz, but he's so important to the Mets, and I think the uncertainty of the opt-outs over the next couple of years doesn't really allow either side to feel comfortable. So personally, and he still has a, remember something really key here with Diaz, he still has the qualifying offer attached to him. He never entered free agency the last time. The Mets will get a draft pick, from what I understand. That is a big deal. So this should be really easy for both sides. You rip up the current contract, you add another year to the contract maybe, or at the very least, you guarantee the next 3 years for Diaz. Let's say you give him the $20 million guarantee on the end. You got the two 18.5s. Maybe you defer some money. I know there's some money deferred now. Maybe the last year is an option where you throw him some signing bonus money, a percentage of what the option may be up front, depending on, you know, how things go. And you get him into his age 35, 36 season. Closers are a lot harder to predict, a little bit easier than what we've talked about with right-handed bats or starting pitchers or other players. Closers in their trajectory are all over the map. You know, Mariano Rivera is good until an all-time good until the age of 43. Billy Wagner, even though he had Tommy John surgery late in his career, was dominant until he retired in his late 30s. Dennis Eckersley, the original closer, didn't start closing until he was 32, had a lot of starting pitching miles on him. You know, back in the day where starters went deep. So closers, you really have to look at individually. It is nerve-wracking signing Diaz to a long-term deal. a four-year deal, knowing that he's a two-pitch pitcher, knowing that fastball has declined a little bit over the last couple of years. But if you look at him, I think he's a more complete pitcher. He knows how to use his slider when he doesn't have his fastball. When he doesn't have his command, he's able to figure things out. He's really evolved into he's always been an elite closer, but I think he's a smarter pitcher now. I think he understands his repertoire. He understands his body. He understands game situations. He knows, you know, what he has to get done and how to get it done. If it's a multi-inning save like you saw him do earlier in the year against Kansas City, or if he needs to go out there and dominate and miss bats in his one-inning stint. I thought one of his most impressive outings of the year was late in the season in Chicago when they needed him for a couple innings, and he was just filthy and nasty, and I think that night he was just going really slider heavy. He just knew what was working and what he needed to do that night to get the job done. And it's not just the Diaz that you saw when he first came in, which, you know, I think was, you know, originally relied a lot on his fastball. Then he became more of a slider heavy guy, and now he's back to, you know, relying a little bit more on his fastball again. So it's almost like he's evolved as a pitcher with the help of obviously the Mets pitching department and the lab and all that other stuff, I'm sure. Ultimately, if David Stearns wants to play chemistry experiment with the bullpen, you got to do it with Diaz there. How are you going to do that without Diaz? How are you going to take that risk? You know, you could go out and maybe you could sign a Rozel Iglesias, and we'll get to him in a minute, as like a short-term deal for a close. Oh, anybody could close the ninth inning, right? I mean, and it's true. Look, a team won a World Series without really a great bullpen, and that's the Dodgers, although I'm sure they'll figure that thing out. And whether or not Diaz, if he does opt out and they do want to, you know, give up a draft pick for him, be interesting how they play that out. I'm sure that's a lot of deferred money that would be part of that. But be that as it may, you know, you have a guy that since 2019 is a top five reliever in the game. He arguably one of the best relievers in the game. You want to say it's Josh Hader. You want to say that Emmanuel Clase, before he got into trouble, was up there. Whatever you want to say. To me, Diaz has been there, and he's been through the gauntlet in New York. He's been on the mound with the ecstasy of closing a series. He's been at a high. He's been at a low. He's had to reinvent himself. He's come back from a serious injury and struggled and looked like he was on the way out, and he had the suspension. And, you know, he's really been through a complete gauntlet here in New York. And I think he's so much the fabric of this team since he came on board in 2019. And having that kind of comfort knowing that the ninth inning, your best arm is probably pitching the ninth inning on any given night. Arguably now, I know as they have some of these young kids come into the equation like McLean or something like that, but on most nights, regardless of who's starting, the best stuff that hitters are going to see and the freshest stuff they're going to see is the ninth inning, and that's Edwin Diaz. And let me tell you, having a guy like that gives you a really high percentage chance of closing out a game, closing out a series, and winning a championship. And it all changes in a big way if he opts out and the Mets let him walk. And I don't see that happening. I think the money's already there. It's just not guaranteed. The structure of the contract is there. If he opts out and the Mets don't come to an accord, either someone threw stupid money at him, which, okay, whatever, there's nothing you could do about that, or they didn't want him, and I just can't see how they didn't want him. Now, Pete Alonso's different, because Pete Alonso, obviously, I think, has much higher aspirations. You've heard about a seven-year deal. My guess is Boris is going to try to sell a seven-year, $200 million contract. I think that's where they're going to want to be, $200 to $210 million. He's going to sell him on being this side of Aaron Judge, one of the best right-handed hitters in baseball. The fact that he's one of the biggest RBI guys in the league since he came in. He's probably going to compare his impact in terms of power, marketability, similar to Judge and the Yankees. And I know that Judge is a superior player and a guy who's an outfielder, much better on the other side of the ball, better hitter, better overall hitter. But I think in terms of the fact that Pete's the Mets' all-time leading home run hitter, that Pete is this New York icon, that you just can't replace 125 RBIs overnight. How if you pull him out of that lineup, the one right-handed bat that balances that lineup goes away, and the fact of the options. He's not stupid. Boris is looking at the options out there on the free agent market too, and he also probably has his ears out there to what right-handed bats are available. You know, you go out and you bring in an Alex Bregman on free agency to play third, or Yandy Diaz on a trade to play first, and maybe you do something with Brett Beatty, either put him at second base or, you know, trade him in a deal for a pitcher, what have you. You're still bringing in good bats, and Bregman's a good bat. Diaz is a component bat, a really good component bat. I don't know if you're replacing a guy that could wreck a game with a home run, could win a game with a home run, and consistently is just going to be, even when he's not been great in terms of batting average and he struggled, he's still a guy that's been a run producer, an RBI guy. And I think Keith Hernandez talked about it with Joel Sherman and John Heyman recently. Where are you going to get 125 RBIs? And if they let Pete walk, and I have to think that there'll be more of a market for Pete Alonso. Maybe the Yankees get involved in it. You know, what about, you know, the Phillies, depending on what's going on with Bryce Harper and what they want to do with Bryce Harper. You know, there's talk of them getting rid of Castellanos. Would Bryce Harper go back to the outfield? How's his arm feeling? You know, put Pete at first base. You know, San Francisco. You know, who else would potentially be? You know, is Toronto now with Vlad signing? I don't think Toronto would be involved in him. He was one of the names that came up. You know, that was one of the teams that came up this past offseason before Vlad Guerrero had signed his extension. I still don't know what kind of market is out there for Pete, but I think a five-year, $150 million contract, even though people are going to say $30 million AAV is a little bit of a stretch, puts him into his, you know, basically mid-30s. I think that, you know, the Mets know Pete. The Mets know Pete's the kind of guy that when he says he's going to do something, he puts his mind to it. He's usually done it. You've seen that since the day he won the job in spring training in 2019. And when he told David Stearns last offseason he wants to hit 500 home runs, he wants to put himself in the conversation for the Hall of Fame, I mean, the guy probably is going to do his best to actually make that happen. I think the defense, which is a concern, he'll work on. I think eventually he's going to have to DH. I think he knows that. I don't think he's ready for that. I think that that's a conversation that as time goes on and his body needs some kind of maintenance, I think he's erudite, hopefully, enough to listen to his body. And he's the kind of guy that's not a clunker to the point where I think Mark Vientos is probably not going to ever be in the field after a certain point in his career. Pete's a guy that I think age might get up to him, but he's not a total clunker in the field where you can't play him at first base. He's not, and I'm dating myself with some names, not Dick Stewart. And again, like I've mentioned that in prior episodes, go look up Dick Stewart, former right-handed slugging first baseman for the Pirates back in the 60s. So these two guys are musts. There's no way around it. And if one or both of these guys are not back, the entire direction of the offseason changes. Everything that I'm laying out for you after we take the break is under the assumption they come to an agreement with Diaz, they come to an agreement with Pete Alonso. And I think they will, and I think they have to. And I think in the case of Diaz, there's both sides are too tied to each other that they really can't go anywhere else, and I think everything is all there for them to figure it out. Alonso's different. I think Alonso was very hurt by how things went last offseason. I think he came back, and he basically was challenged by the Mets to show that he's not a declining player, and he did show that. I think he wants to be rewarded for his work and appreciated for his work here in New York, and I think he does want to hit 500 home runs, and I think he wants to go in the Hall of Fame. I think he would love to go to the Hall of Fame as a Met, but I will tell you this, he is not going to take a discount to stay in New York, and I think he's a guy that if somebody else throws him big money and blows him out of the water or throws him a stupid contract that the Mets just don't feel comfortable with, he will take it, as would most of players. And is there a threshold? And I think that that goes back to what I said earlier to kick off the program, that there's no guarantees. So sometimes going all in, when it comes to money, I think going all in is a different situation than ripping apart from depth or prospects or current capital, player capital on the roster. I mean, Cohen's basically spending 90% of his payroll, you know, revenues towards payroll. What does payroll flexibility look like post potential lockout and a new CBA? We don't know. But at this point, I think $30 million AAV for a guy that get 40 home runs, driving 125 runs, and probably will do so over the next 3 to 4 years. Maybe the last year of a five-year contract, you know, maybe that last year doesn't look great. Obviously, he'll be a DH late in the contract. I wouldn't want to go to seven. I wonder if it would require that level to go to, you know, seven. I don't know. You know, what's more important to Pete, AAV or years? I think they're not too far apart from what he would have gotten after 2023. You know, he got his, you know, $20 million or so in 2024. He got another $30 million this past year. You know, so basically, if you talk about a seven-year contract extension, you already got 1 year in. You give him another 5 years. It turns out, you know, the actual contract, you know, was 6 years. If you count the $30 million he got on the one-year deal before the opt-out, you know, it's 6 years and, you know, $180 million combined. You know, maybe that 200 is the magic number. You know, I don't know how they could bridge that gap. But at this point, I don't think Cohen and the Mets, when it comes to money, are going to let, you know, in the case of Diaz, really, you talk about it, it's a couple opt-out years and $20 million. You talk about both players combined, it's about $40 to $50 million that is going to bridge the gap for both of these guys. Combined, really, when you think about it. That's not a lot of money. In the world of Cohen, in the world of Major League Baseball, in the monopoly world that they live in. Not in the real world like you and I live in it, in the monopoly world. So, the whole offseason begins with these two guys. Depending on what these guys do, it could veer off in different directions. It'll be interesting with Alonso, how this gets dragged by Boris. It'll definitely go into the winter meetings. If it starts to drag, or he really wants to drag it past the winter meetings into the new year, that's when I think that might be a problem for the Mets, because that will hold them up and freeze the market. And I think that potentially could be where things could get ugly. But I think this is a thing that the first part of the offseason, when you talk about early hot stove, going into the winter meetings, it's going to be about Diaz. It's going to be about Pete. My prediction is Diaz gets done quickly. Pete gets done at the winter meetings. And I think that it'll be interesting where it goes. And I think unless the Mets don't want him back, and I think you'll hear a little bit more about that and you'll get a vibe about that soon in the next week or so. You know, I think their plan is to have Pete back and to build the offense around Pete and Nimmo and Soto. And they have to figure out which one of their kids they're going to keep. And, you know, I think the offense really is a tweaking situation to improve some of the up-the-middle defense, because I think they like the offense. I think this offseason is going to be about the starting pitching, and particularly the starting pitching. Not just the pitch, it's the pitching, the starting pitching, less about the bullpen. So, all right, let's take a quick break. Stay or go, Mets have some free agents. We're going to talk about them, and we're also going to talk about some names I'd like to see acquire this offseason as we set up the hot stove. Our first Hot Stove show, now that the World Series is over, officially now it's the Hot Stove season, even though it's 60 degrees out today and it doesn't really feel like the Hot Stove, it's upon us. Fall is here. Daylight savings time is gone. There's a little chill on the pumpkin. Halloween. Leaves falling. We are officially past the baseball season. We are officially into the Hot Stove season. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, we're back. So what about the Mets free agents? What about some names that we're going to be looking for this offseason? Stearns will be at the GM meetings. Those are in about a week. He's always very present with the media, so we'll probably hear a little bit more about his thoughts. One of the first things he talked about after the season was supporting the players with better coaching. You've already seen them work on that. You know, pitching is going to be a big part of the conversation. The big free agents, I think, are the first dominoes that have to fall. We talked about that with Diaz and Alonso. They do have some of their own free agents. Not all of them are guys that I would just let walk. I think there's a couple that I think the Mets should work hard to try to keep. And then, of course, what are some names on the free agent market or trades that I'm looking for that may be available, and could the Mets target and focus in on them? So, you know, the first thing here, now that we've talked about Diaz and Alonso, is they have a couple of player options, you know, club options on players, Brooks Raley and Drew Smith. Now, I don't know anything about Drew Smith's rehab. I'm assuming it's going well. And if it is going well, there's a guy that I bring back. There's a guy that, you know, at one point many thought he could potentially help Diaz as the closer. You know, he's always been inconsistent. He would drive you crazy, sort of like Reed Garrett. Garrett's out for the year, so you know he might take that Reed Garrett role, that sixth, seventh inning guy, maybe do better with it. You know, maybe now that he's had Tommy John surgery, maybe now he can, you know, go out there and be the version of Drew Smith that we always thought he could be with that electric fastball. Brooks Raley, to me, is a no-brainer, a really reasonable, I think it's $4.5 million option. They, you know, they paid him, you know, to come in and rehab this year. And it was rewarded, where he's one of their best relievers outside of Diaz down the stretch. I think him and Tyler Rogers, because of the failures of the 83-win season, don't get enough credit, because they really were carrying the water there when Helsley did not step up, and Helsley was a disaster. So I think Brooks Raley and Drew Smith are pretty easy options to stay, to pick up their options. I'm saying the caveat with Drew Smith, because we don't know much about his health, so we'll take, you know, we'll take it that he is healthy, and I think those will be two very early important pieces that you could put in the bullpen along with Diaz. Now, the next thing is, what do you do with some of the other bullpen arms? So when you start to look at who's there, Tyler Rogers. I think Tyler Rogers, and if you look over the last 6 years, he's top 25 reliever in baseball in terms of WAR. He's not sexy. He doesn't throw hard. He has that funky Dan Quisenberry delivery that is not common anymore in baseball. I think at times he can be an elite setup guy, even though he doesn't miss bats. He walks less than one batter per nine innings. He has one of the top ground ball rates in the league at over 60%. I think it's about 65%. And he's the kind of guy in a bullpen, and I know the Mets bullpen will be made up with hard throwers, throw a lot of sliders, miss a lot of bats. You know, I'm not saying Justin Willard won't come in and have an impact, but, you know, historically the Mets walk a ton of batters, you know, to the tune sometimes of 3, 4, 5 per nine with some of their elite stuff guys. Maybe they improve upon that. Rodgers comes into a game and I think quiets it down and puts it to sleep. Now, I know the contact could be a problem. Weak contact leads to bleeders and dunks and bloopers and those ground balls into no man's land. And you would like, you know, hitters to miss bats because when there's runners on base, it makes it less likely for advancement. But nothing is, to me, more calming than a pitcher that comes in, throws strikes, elicits weak contact. You know, he's got a bit of a rubber arm, I think, so you could probably get 80 appearances out of him. You know, maybe more, you know, back-to-backs than your average reliever because he doesn't throw that hard. And I think he just puts a calm into the game and stabilizes. When he came in to games that were kind of getting wild, I felt he would stabilize it. I always was very confident with him on the mound, and I know that the numbers didn't always give a lot of hits, but I think that he's just a guy that, now that he's got his New York experience under his belt, you go out, maybe give him a 2-year deal, $20 million. I don't know at his age, in his 30s, if he'll command a 3-year deal, but I would bring Tyler Rogers back. And I think he can potentially be a backup closer. I know you guys think I'm crazy. I just like pitchers that throw strikes. I'm old school in that way. I know I'm talking like it's the 80s and Dan Quisenberry or is closing for the Royals. But I'm not saying he should be a primary closer, but I think backing up Diaz, I have a lot of confidence that he could get big hitters out because, as you know, he reminds me a little bit of Chad Bradford too. With those submariners that go underneath, it's very hard to elevate. Less likely you're going to have game tying home runs or hard contact. And, you know, the Mets defense should be good enough to be able to navigate some ground balls because they got a pitcher, one of their core pitchers. Clay Holmes is one of those guys as well. So definitely Tyler Rogers. Ryan Helsley, I think the New York experience, I don't know if it was New York, the tipping of pitches, you know, there was always some red flags with him coming in about left-handed batters hit him hard. His fastball has been crushed. There was a lot of red flags coming in. I thought it was a good deal. I still stand by that. You were getting a closer. You weren't giving up the elite prospect capital that you needed to give up to get a Mason Miller like what San Diego did. That would have been the perfect guy. And listen, if you had Mason Miller, you might even play chicken with Diaz and let him opt out. I guarantee you they would have at that point. It'd be a much different situation. Be that as it may, that's not reality. Helsley, to me, even if you were able to get him to come in, reestablish his market, pitch the eighth inning, back up Diaz, I just don't think it's a good fit. I think there's so many negative context to him coming back. I don't think the fans will be patient with him. If he's bad off the bat, you're going to boo him. I think Helsley's a guy that is going to have to, and I bet you maybe even goes back to St. Louis. He's going to go somewhere on a short deal to close, reestablish his market, and then maybe go back out there. Guy throws hard, no doubt. I was at the game. He could throw 101. He throws the hardest on the staff, harder than Diaz at this point. But he's just very hittable. I mean, he's one of the most hittable 100-mile-per-hour guys that I've seen, and I think it's just time to let him go. The other bullpen arm, Gregory Soto, is a lefty. I wouldn't just let Soto walk. Now, there are other lefties that will be available on the market, and I definitely think the Mets need a lefty. They need somebody. I know they have Brooks Raley. A.J. Minter probably won't be ready to start this season. There's a couple of lefties out there. There's Tyler Rogers' brother, Taylor, Gregory Soto, Danny Colum, Justin Wilson. You guys know him. He's a little bit older. He's age 38. I think Soto's one of the better ones. Now, Soto is better against lefties than righty in a league that isn't a situational loogie league that could be somewhat problematic. But if you could bring Soto back, who's really nasty against lefties, on a reasonable 1-year, maybe 2-year deal again, you're looking at that, you know, $10 to $20 million range. And I know what I'm proposing here is outside of the Stearns comfort level. But, you know, when you look at the Mets and you look at, you know, where they're at in terms of some of the options to play the chemistry experiment that Stearns has been known for, You know, there's some names already on the roster that aren't bad. You have Dylan Ross. You've got Justin Hageman. Oscar Brazenbaum, talked to him over in terms of, you know, tendering him a contract. I mentioned tender him a contract. Talked to him over at Beyond the Mic in a segment we did, a piece we did over there. I mentioned Drew Smith. They have some names, and that doesn't include some names in the minors, maybe a Ryan Lambert. There may be some guys down there. We'll see how they develop. Who knows what they do with some of the starters. Maybe a Weniger or somebody like that becomes a reliever. As they transition into their big league roles, potentially, if they're around, if they're not part of a deal. So you do have some guys in the system you can play chemistry experiment with. And I know Diaz is going to be expensive, and I'm advocating for the Mets to bring in a couple of relievers that I think potentially can make about $10 million AAV. But I think they're relievers that have value. I think that they need some certainty in that bullpen. I think that you can't just do Diaz and, you know, hope that you could find out who the bridge to Diaz is and spend half the year doing that. You may still need to do that. But if you have a Rodgers, if you have a Gregory Soto, if you have a Brooks Raley, and then maybe you add AJ Minter to that, and maybe you go out and you sign a more value veteran arm, if possible, as the offseason gets deeper. Now, part of that bullpen, and this is what would really add to it, and I don't know if they can or they'd be comfortable, not that they can't, they'd be comfortable doing that and a Rodgers, but getting a real legit second closer on a one-year deal. Now, guys that are available are Kenley Jansen and, you know, a guy like that, a veteran that, you know, may potentially be, you know, slightly over the hill at this point. You have Robert Suarez, probably not an option when Diaz is back. Emilio Pagan, who was closing for Cincinnati. Kyle Finnegan, we mentioned Helsley. I think the guy, now Finnegan is interesting because he pitched much better in Detroit, and I think that he's one of those guys pitching in Washington that wasn't a great closer, tend to be at times kerosene on the fire, although he had his moments. If he can figure out his repertoire, and I think the Mets are a perfect kind of team to do that, he could potentially be a great setup guy and backup closer. He's in his mid-30s like a lot of these guys are. Jansen's at the end of his rope. Pagan in his 30s. You know, obviously, Finnegan's 33. I don't know if it would require a really long-term deal. My guess is most of these guys, if they want to continue to get paid, the saves and being a closer means something. Does that change as the league moves away from looking at traditional stats? You know, we'll see. Rosell Iglesias, and again, I don't know if he'd want to come here and set up for Diaz, but even though he didn't have a banner year or his typical year in Atlanta, he still had a whip under one. His advanced metrics still are pretty solid in terms of his chase and his whiff rate. It looks like maybe it was just one of those years where he was unlucky a little bit, or maybe there was something to do with his mechanics, because if you go to his Savant page, he was particularly hittable with his slider, which traditionally that wasn't the case. So maybe it's a small tweak. Maybe it was just something, you know, that was an outlier, of course, in a career that has been, you know, really solid. I mean, he's a guy that, if you remember back in 2022, when Atlanta acquired him from Anaheim to bolster the bullpen, he was a big part down the stretch for him. This was a name that I remember talking about in terms of maybe the Mets going out and getting. So I think Rosell Iglesias is a definite name I'd like to see the Mets bring in. I like Tyler Rogers. I like Soto. I don't want to make it Rogers, Iglesias, and or. I like both. I don't know if they'll spend to that level on the bullpen. It will be interesting. I think it might be in terms of years they're looking at versus AAV. I'm advocating right now putting about, you know, $30 million into the bullpen, AAV, with those three names. Soto might be more of a name they could, because they have Raley, because they have the lefty, because Minter won't be out that long. You know, maybe Danny Young is an option. I know he's coming back from Tommy John surgery. Maybe they could get a veteran lefty later in the winter at a cheaper cost. But I think Iglesias and Rogers are the two names out of that bullpen, along with Diaz. And then you could play your shuttling and your, you know, chemistry experiment and add at the deadline and all those things. But you want to solidify that earlier in the season, because you could lose games early. Diaz is a guy that they've paced throughout his tenure. They pitch him a little bit harder in the second half than in the first half. They baby him a lot early in the season. So you're definitely going to need that backup closer. You're going to need a solid bridge. Those names are some early names I'm giving you that I think are the direction that the Mets should go. Now, wrapping up the bullpen, no Ryan Stanek. We know that his best days are behind him. Straight fastball, no command was one of the big reasons why that bullpen struggled down the stretch. I think Carlos Mendoza went to him too much. So big no on Ryan Stanek. Now, going to some of the other free agents on the Mets roster, who else would I bring back? I would not bring back Cedric Mullins. I think he falls under the Helsley category. Got to find an upgrade. Didn't look comfortable in New York. Certainly looked like his skills have eroded. Would not be able to come back in even on a prove-it deal and really survive the fan backlash. I think Starling Marte has been an incredible Met, all-star, big part of the 22 team. He was a big part of the 24 OMG Mets, seemed to always be involved in big rallies. Showed some life with his bat this year, especially because the Mets needed it middle of the season, you know, when Winker went down. And I think he showed great leadership, and he was a big part of helping Juan Soto transition into the Mets culture. But at some point, you know, especially in on a roster where you're carrying 13 pitchers and you're only going to have, you know, 9 starters and 4 bench players, a guy that really can't play the field, is a DH without much power, and is more of a veteran leader, I don't know if you have the room for them. In the pre-13 pitcher days, Marte's a guy you'd bring back and have on the bench. And you'd love to have a veteran, but you need that spot for a pitcher. So unfortunately, I just don't see Marte as somebody that fits, even though it would be nice to have his veteran influence in the clubhouse. Jesse Winker is a guy that I'd do no more than invite him if he's healthy or he wants to prove he's healthy. I know he's had back issues, which to me sounds very ominous that his career might be coming to an end. If Jesse Winker wants a minor league invite to prove himself in spring training, maybe spend some time in Syracuse if he doesn't make the club, I'd be up for that. I don't know where he's at in terms of his health, in terms of what kind of options he has out there. So Jesse Winker is definitely somebody that I'd bring in as a show-me contract, but would not give him any kind of guaranteed deal. The only other free agent that the Mets currently have that I would re-sign, and he wouldn't be available probably till the second half after the All-Star break, is Griffin Canning. I know that they did a lot of work with him. I think that he was one of the success stories from the lab, and you know, very freakish injury with the ACL coming down so awkwardly. It's one of those things where it was a shame because who knows what his season could have been. But for the first time in his career, it looked like they kind of, and this is something that when you look at someone like Kyle Finnegan, you know, perhaps this is kind of where the Mets would go with a Finnegan looking at his repertoire, maybe tweaking it a little bit. But Canning was a guy that coming in, he was a guy that got in trouble throwing his fastball. But they mixed in his slider, they mixed in his changeup, they worked on his pitch shaping. He wasn't great. He was starting to falter a little bit when he got hurt. But early in the season, he was similar to Clay Holmes. He give you a really good 5 innings, and he was a guy that would give you about 5 innings, 3 runs. Solid. And it would have been interesting to see how the rest of his season turned out. You know, he had already had 7 wins. You know, he probably was a guy that was going to win 12, 13 ball games. Would have given them some, you know, good starts down the stretch, maybe become a bullpen option. I mean, ultimately, the kids had to step in and get it done, and they did what they could do. But, you know, Griffin Canning was someone that definitely was missed down the stretch and was potentially one of the poster children of the whole pitching lab and what have you. So I try to bring him back maybe on a multi-year deal, rehab most of the first year, similar to what they did with Raley. Try to see if you get him back and you know, what does that look like? What kind of value does a Griffin Canning have? You know, a basic starter has, you know, $15 million a year value just for 6 innings, 3 runs. Maybe, you know, 2 years, $15 million, make the second year an option. But I would think about bringing back Griffin Canning. Now, as far as the rest of the rotation, as you go outside the organization, I think the name that I'm really looking at, because I think he could be had for a short-term deal with an opt-out. And I think the other option, which is an innings option, which is Framber Valdez in Houston, but it's Dylan Cease. Now, I had said that the Mets need to chase an ace. And I don't want to get again into Skubal and Skeens. They're going to try to go after an ace. That's going to be another part of the whole offseason conversation, the Tarik Skubal situation. And we'll see if he's even available. when you talk about Pete and Edwin Diaz, the next thing is there an ace for them to chase? And that's not enough. The Mets need to get some innings into this rotation because I don't think Senga's going to give them innings. You know, maybe a Peterson or a Holmes could start pushing into the 175, 180, 185 inning situation. I don't know what Sean Manaea can do. Can he get back to 180 to 200 innings after the kind of year he had? The kids are not necessarily going to be pushing that 180 to 200 innings. So the Mets need innings, and I think Dylan Cease and Framber Valdez are two guys of the free agent market that could give you innings. Now, you guys know I haven't been a big Dylan Cease guy because he is inconsistent. He has elite stuff. He's a guy that could strike out well over 200 per nine. He does struggle with command and control. He's a guy that you saw him against the Mets give up some big innings just this past August. Traditionally, the Mets have hit him pretty well. But then he could dominate and throw near perfect stuff. So he's one of those guys that I think will win 12 to 13 games. He'll be really good in those 13 to 15 to 18 starts. He'll be really bad for another dozen starts. Or very mediocre. I shouldn't say really bad, a dozen starts. So he's going to be kind of an up and down. Valdez is a little older, more reliant on ground balls, probably going to require a longer-term deal. If Cease indeed is looking to prove himself on a short-term deal with opt-outs, and that's an option for the Mets to maybe pay a lot for 1 year, let him get back out on the market, that's the guy you go after. Because you'll get the best version of Cease, then you can decide whether or not you want to bring him back after that. And it gives you a year of having a pitcher in your rotation that has a track record to kind of get your McClain, your Tong, your Sproat back on track. Again, assuming that they're part of that rotation and they don't go in a Tarik Skubal train at that point. So I'd pick Cease over Valdez, mainly because I think of the shorter-term nature. I've heard rumors that there's a possibility that he didn't have the best season, you know, probably wants to do a little bit of what you saw like a Blake Snell do, and then get the opt-out and go back into the market. And that I'm fine with that. Valdez, you know, good again, a good option, lefty. But, you know, ultimately a guy that's going to probably get a 6 or 7 year deal. There was some clubhouse issues with him and the catcher. A little bit older. The one thing about Valdez I don't like, his best pitch is the most hittable pitch. I mean, that's the pitch he throws the most. And I shouldn't say his best pitch. The pitch he throws the most, his fastball, is the one that's the most hittable. And that bothers me a lot. A lot of contact there and a lot of chance for that to be a bad contract pretty quickly. On the trade front, and I wrote about this over Beyond the Mic, but I think George Kirby's one pitcher and one name, he fits so much of what the Mets potentially could use. Now, I used the analogy about how the Astros went out and they plucked Gerrit Cole from Pittsburgh. He was a good pitcher. He had some success. He seemed to be meandering and not getting himself to the next level. Went into the Houston organization and became a star. Got a big contract from the Yankees. Became the best pitcher, one of the best pitchers in baseball. Now, George Kirby is somebody that has that potential. And if you look, he's a guy that, you know, Rye, New York guy, a local kid, you know, had a really good year. You know, finished eighth in the Cy Young voting at 25 years old, his second year in the league. And, you know, has had some shoulder issues and injuries, but he's a command guy. He throws strikes. He's only 27 years old. He was pitching really well in Game 7. He didn't get a chance to go more than, what, 3-4 innings, but would have been interesting to see what he could have done if he was kept in the game. Seattle's got a ton of pitchers that are going to be getting expensive. You know, maybe they're going to be looking for bats. I don't know if he's available. Jerry DePoto always is looking to make big trades. Would the Mets, and the last time they made a deal with Jerry DePoto was the big controversial Kelenic deal, if Kirby is someone that can be plucked, if they feel that his upside and potential and his cost as he gets into arbitration years now, it's worth to maybe see what the market would be, I'd be all in on that. He's the perfect age. Now, I know that there's a Joe Ryan or somebody like that, and I certainly would look at a Joe Ryan, but Kirby to me is, you know, Ryan's 29 going on 30. Kirby is 27 going on 28. You get a couple of years of control. You get a chance to really see what you have. And look, as a local guy, you know, somebody that potentially could come here, maybe they could work on his repertoire. They could work on, you know, keeping him healthy and getting him to the next level. He's not a free agent until 2029. You know, maybe in the next couple of years, if he proves himself, you sign him to a long-term deal. And then with Kirby, McClain, Tong, maybe he develops. You got a couple of veterans in there. All of a sudden, you don't have to rip apart the entire farm system and your roster to get an ace like Tarik Skubal, pay $400 million for the privilege and then, you know, see him get hurt 3 years into a contract. One thing to give Pete a five-year deal, or Diaz to get, you know, three- or four-year deal into their mid-30s. Given a 10-year deal, albeit to the best pitcher, starting pitcher in baseball, at least 1A next to Skeens, probably number two. Skeens would be number one. That's more likely to go bad than, you know, what you see on the offensive side or what we've talked about in terms of some of the contracts for Diaz and what have you. I'm very cautious, and this goes back to what I said in the open. You know, you want to be able to go out there and go all in to win, but you have to be careful. And I don't even know if school is available, but the reason I'm focused more on them going out and trading for some, acquiring some innings on free agency, maybe trying to find a George Kirby or a Joe Ryan type that could come here and elevate their game to the next level, is because I think that the cost of acquiring somebody else's ace, not just with payroll, percentage of payroll when you put $40 million into one pitcher, but also in prospect capital, makes it very risky for a team that does not know what payroll flexibility and what roster movement will look like in a new CBA. So I'd be really careful. I'd be really careful about ripping the farm up to win a headline in December. So you notice I didn't talk a lot about Skubal. I didn't talk about the Aces because I don't think Skeens is going to be traded. I'm not so sure about Skubal. I think now is a situation, especially because of the politics behind it, because it's a contending team that would want to trade their ace. It probably would take an overpay. I think Cohen and the Mets are always going to get taxed a little bit on that. So I think the direction this offseason should be going more towards who is the next pitcher to put themselves into that top five, top 10 starting pitchers in baseball pantheon. Maybe like how the Phillies brought Zach Wheeler in when he was ready to extend. You could think about it that way. You know, start to continue to develop your arms, see what other arms you could bring into the organization under this new pitching regime that you could get the best out of, and maybe go to war that way. You may have an ace already that you developed in Nolan McClain. You may have that. Who knows what Jonah Tong could be? And I know going into the season with some question marks in the rotation is scary. But if you ask me, if you could solidify the bullpen with some veteran arms and get some innings like a Cease, or maybe even bring in an established guy with some upside like a Kirby or a Joe Ryan, those will be expensive enough, don't get me wrong, because they have control. But I'm not sure that they will be ripped the roster apart expensive like you would have to do with a Tarik Skubal, or especially with a Paul Skeens, and then build that kind of rotation, see what you got. If you have a more solidified bullpen and you actually, you know, work on the offense, bring Pete Alonso back, maybe find yourself a better defensive center fielder. I would love for them to reunite with Harrison Bader while they're waiting for Carson Bench. I mean, I think that's the last piece of this whole thing. You know, if you, and this only happens, the offense only happens if Pete comes back. If Pete doesn't come back, it's a whole different scenario. But if you have Pete coming back, you know, you put Beatty at third, you've got Lindor at second, you've got Soto and Nimmo in the corners, you know, potentially could go out there and maybe look for some veteran bats that could DH out there on the market. I don't think they're going to get into the Kyle Schwarber market. I don't think they're going to get into the Kyle Tucker market. I would love for them to look at Cody Bellinger, but with Benj potentially being ready, and I think that that's a big part of this offseason, and they believe in Benj. They like Benj from what I understand. So anything they do in center field is going to be short term. I think Harrison Bader, and I'm not saying that he's going to be the 300 hitter that he was in Philly. The metrics still indicate that maybe he was a little bit over-indexed offensively last year. But if he's figured out where he can be a league average hitter, and with his glove in center, he's a valuable component player. He was sorely missed this year. So I would try to do a reunion with Harrison Bader. I personally, after they sign Alonso, could see them going more component-driven on the offensive side, you know, maybe adding some defensive component players. But ultimately, I think that if Pete Alonso doesn't sign, then that's where this thing gets thrown into a little bit of flux, because Josh Naylor, left-handed bat. You know, would they revisit maybe a Kyle Schwarber, again, a left-handed bat, if Pete doesn't sign, to clog up the DH role? That changes the offseason dramatically. But if Alonso resigns, I think they go component on offense. I think they get more aggressive on the pitching side. I would get a little bit more bullish on investing some money in the bullpen on veterans. And then really it's going to be about the kids. Can they incorporate Benj at some point in 2026, like Conforto was incorporated into the 2015 club? Can they, you know, continue to see development from their three starting pitchers and maybe add with a Will Watson, a Jack Winiger, somebody like that? Don't forget Jonathan Santucci, basically somebody from their system that is the next man up from the Tong, the Sproat, and the McLean trio that came up this year. So I don't think it's going to be an offseason where the Mets win headlines throughout the offseason. I think they're going to go in on some big players. I think they're going to examine trying to get an ace. But I think the players and the kind of moves that I talked about on this show, it goes back to the theme of what I started. You're all in, but you got to do it with both an eye to responsibly managing your payroll in an uncertain world. And the Mets have done a really good job with that. And they invest, as I said, you can't criticize Cohen. He invests every single dime he possibly can into payroll. Trying to upgrade the rotation and do it in a way where there's some upside, not just for next year, but for the future. Bringing in some innings. And then, of course, maybe bring in some more certainty to the bridge to Diaz. But it all starts with Diaz and Alonso. It really does. And maybe if you want to add the whole conversation around Tarik Skubal, whether he's available or not, because that's another thing. You can't let that linger all offseason. But it starts with Diaz and Alonso. And this whole offseason plan or names that I'm targeting, that completely changes if either one of those guys splits. Bullpen, you got to look at differently. All of a sudden, it's a whole different situation. And if Alonso splits, it throws a lot of flux into the positional side. And then we would have to just redo it over at that point. But I really don't see both of these players are too tethered to the Mets. The Mets need them. They need the Mets. Maybe in the case of Diaz more so than Alonso. I just can't see. It makes too much sense for both of these sides not to figure it out. In a lot of ways, they're tied to each other. And they really, and even with the fact that Alonso doesn't have a qualifying offer, I really think that he's in a position where I don't think he'll get a better deal and the visibility that he so craves outside of New York. I really don't. I mean, unless maybe the Yankees are going to pop in. I think the Yankees have their eyes on other things. And I think it's a finite group of teams that are going to spend the money that Pete wants. I think Pete Alonso as a first baseman in New York with the Mets has more value than Pete Alonso as a first baseman somewhere else because of, I think that in the analytics world and his limitations on defense and maybe some of his questions on his body type, I think an outsider looking at him is a little bit different than potentially, you know, the Mets and an organization that has gotten to know him and knows the kind of guy he is. And again, I think the real intangible and the thing that you're betting on with Pete is when he says he's going to do something, he puts his head to it, whether it's improving his plate discipline like he did this year, rebounding from a tough 22-year stretch, maybe he'd be challenged to be a better first baseman. He's going to put the work in, and he's going to potentially show a lot of people that maybe he's not going to be a gold glover, but he could be a much improved first baseman. Maybe he's not going to be a 300 hitter like a Paul Goldschmidt, but he can be the 40 home run, 125 RBI player that everybody knows he can be and that what the Mets need. Now, is he ready to hit another level in his career that we haven't seen where maybe you saw a little bit, especially down the stretch, he was big and he could start hitting maybe 270, 280 and maybe add, more consistent offense outside of the power. You saw that with the doubles this year into his repertoire. That's a possibility. And I think that's all the decisions that Stearns and has to make as they try to figure out what kind of investment they can make in Alonso and what they're comfortable with. So, it's been kind of hard today because we're in that post-World Series, that small lull you'll have with the hot stove. So really what I'm doing is taking weeks of conversations we've had here and summarizing them, showing you what I'm looking to see the Mets to do. We do this every year. And then ultimately it gets blown up and the Mets take something in a different direction and we veer off in that direction and what we talk about today gets thrown in the trash almost immediately. But I think I'm pretty much in the ballpark of what we're going to see. And outside of going and inquiring a Tarik Skubal or a Big Ace, these are good moves. I'm not so sure they're headline-grabbing moves. I don't know if the fans will be happy with everything that I'm talking about here, but I think this is a more realistic focus and direction they could go in the offseason. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to see, listen to Stearns at the GM meetings. He never lies to us. He always gives us the breadcrumbs that we need to assess where this is going. We're going to be following the news cycle throughout the offseason. We're going to be listening to what the people in charge are actually saying, not speculating or using educated speculation or reacting to every rumor that gets thrown out there. Because remember, there's a lot of writers that say the Mets could be interested in someone like this, which means I think this is kind of like a name that would be interesting, but I don't have any real information behind it. But because I have the New York Post or, you know, another publication next to my name, I get credibility that it's a rumor because the Mets could be interested. Listen to the words. Beware of educated speculation. Forget about the fake rumor mill. That's the thing that's going to drive everybody nuts. That's a whole nother thing because of Twitter and social media and all that other stuff. So anyway, kind of a setup show for the offseason. Of course, we'll be with you, breaking news, doing shows. If you're not a member yet of Beyond the Mic, come join the community, chat with us for free. You want to be a premium member, we'd love to have you. So keep going to TalkingMetsPodcast.com for the latest. All right, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You can check me out all the time, like I said, at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I'd love for you to join our new and improved website, like I said, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Come chat with us for free. If you want to get the premium content, we follow up on a lot of the things I've talked about today. We've already followed up on in the premium part of the program, as well as we'll dive into. And one of the things this week we'll be diving into, we'll examine, and I've been meaning to do that, the history of Mets trades of big starters. How did they work for the Mets? We'll also dive into some of the innings eaters and maybe talk about that a little bit. Dive a little bit deeper into the Framber Valdezes and the Dylan Ceases and the guys like that, and get a real feel of some of the names that are out there. So go to TalkingMetsPodcast.com and get updates for the show. Join in the conversation after the show. We'd love to have you. All right, I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.